failure to adopt value-based care models, failure to adopt technology, failure to orient yourself toward the patient is actually an existential threat. We heard that from one of the panelists while we were here.
You're listening to Decoding Healthcare Innovation with Carrie Nixon and Rebecca Gwilt, a podcast for novel and disruptive business leaders seeking to transform how we receive and experience healthcare.
Hi everyone, it's Carrie and Rebecca coming to you from HLTH 2021, and we are here to give you some of our hot takes from the conference. Rebecca, have you had a good time so far?
I've had an amazing time so far, Carrie. This is a bananas conference. You can tell there's a lot of pent-up energy. Everybody's so excited to get back in person and see each other. At the same time, they've done a tremendous job here making sure everybody feels safe, making sure that we are fed and watered and all the things that humans need. I'm super glad to be here. And I'm glad to be here with you personally, live, Carrie.
I know.
We rarely sit next to each other for these podcasts.
It's very exciting. It's very exciting. But no, I will join you in giving kudos to the team at HLTH. They have really rocked this conference. It's spectacular. It's fun. It's well organized. And best of all, they had puppies at check-in.
They did have puppies.
To make everyone happy.
They had puppies.
While they were waiting for their COVID testing.
I was really surprised. They also have a salon here.
A salon.
You can get your
studio.
Hair did. you can get your face put on.
We have not done that. Hence, you are not seeing us on video today.
That's right. We're here for business, folks. All business.
All right.
The other thing, wait a minute. One more thing I would like to say, and kudos to the health folks, is this is the most female-friendly conference that I have ever been to.
Absolutely.
It's been tremendous, the effort and intentionality of making sure that the panels are balanced, making sure that there are events connecting, you know, senior female leaders in the space with other folks, providing encouragement and fellowship. And I have enjoyed all of the events here, but in particular have been struck by, again, the intentionality with which they designed things for supporting women in tech, women in the life sciences. It's just been tremendous.
Diverse voices and faces across all panels, very much appreciated and much needed.
Yeah.
All right, so let's get to our hot takes.
Let's do it.
We're going to start with value-based care. Liz Fowler from the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation made a few announcements at the conference today. And in particular, she announced the goal of 100% of Medicare beneficiaries participating in a value-based care model by 2030.
Huge. That,
yeah, it's a pretty audacious goal, for
huge.
Sure. We've made good progress, though, thus far, since the value-based care and delivery models first started. I think we're at 30-some percent now of beneficiaries?
Yeah, I think 30% is the right number. Yeah, and you know, what's exciting is we haven't seen probably all of the APMs or alternative payment models that are going to come out.
Yeah.
Carrie and I actually started the firm back in the old days of the MSSP ACO program, and certainly there have been innovative models coming out of CMMI since then, but it really sounded, from what Liz was saying, that they were going to really be putting energy behind this and creating new models that maybe even will improve upon the models that exist today.
Yeah, they mentioned the next gen ACOs is kind of a favorite and one that has done really well. One thing that struck me was that she specifically referenced partnering with commercial payers and with Medicaid on these value-based models. So that they are basically payer agnostic, and that means that providers don't have to sort of worry as much about who is the payer for this particular patient, right? If they are more collaborative and the models are payer agnostic, that's going to be better for providers and it's going to be better for patients. She mentioned sort of reinvigorating the HCP LAN. I forget what that acronym It's the Learning in Action Network. Learning in Action Network. But it's really a public-private partnership that does at least an annual conference. They may have even started out doing twice a year. And I found it to actually be one of the most substantive conferences on value-based care models, hearing directly from the folks at CMS, CMS listening directly to some of the stakeholders in the spaces. It died off a bit during the last administration, but I was really pleased to hear the announcement that they're going to reinvigorate that, because bringing those players to the table is going to be really important if they're going to create partnerships with payers across the spectrum.
Yeah, I think in general, one of the coolest things that I've heard while I was while I've been here is Mickey Tripathi, who is the current national coordinator, and Dan Brillman, who's the CEO of UniteUS, talking about, again, with intentionality, the importance of the partnership between the federal government and industry as they try to regulate around really complex technologies and payment models across the spectrum of a ton of different kinds of providers. That, you know, this concept that it is not only better for industry to be engaged with government so they know what's coming down the pike so that they can stay out of trouble, maybe even influence things to their benefit, to their business benefit. But to hear somebody in government, and again, Mickey spent 20 years in the private sector, so I think he gets this, but to hear somebody in government say, hey, actually, the way to make our policies smart, to make our policies actionable by industry so that they actually create the kind of change we're trying to create, we need private industry at the table, and it's a thread that I'm starting to see honestly, when I was in government, I didn't really see. Mm-hmm. Private industry was sort of the people knocking at the door, interfering with our jobs. I'm really seeing that start to change, which is really exciting, actually.
Hugely important. Full risk contracts, full risk models.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen, you know, this is true alignment in value-based care, right? Yeah. This is your patient population, take care of them for X amount of money, and if you can take care of them for less and maintain quality, that is a great upside for you. The surprising thing that I am learning here at the conference is the breadth of providers who are willing to engage in these full risk contracts.
100%. I have not heard ever before anyone saying, yes, let's go full risk. Let's do these capitated models. It's a huge sea change.
Yeah. And not just folks that are sort of used to managing patient populations across the care spectrum. We're seeing tech companies who have developed their own primary care offering saying, hey, you know, Aetna, I'm really good at this. Give me your sickest patients. Give me your patients that have this disease state. Give me your patients that need this, you know, elevated level of care, and pay me a flat rate. I'm going to take on the risk. I'm going to do a great job because I have educated myself and I'm using these tools and I understand the data. These are companies that you guys would know in the marketplace as, you know, direct-to-consumer brands that are saying, actually, we've figured out, because of all the data we've collected going direct-to-consumer, that we understand better than some of the, you know, more established providers in the country how to take full risk, and we're ready to do it.
Well, and not only that, but I literally heard Roy Schoenberg of Amwell saying that full risk contracts, global payments, are the means of removing the shackles of innovation in healthcare, which I thought was
super
was
powerful.
Really striking, very, very powerful. So, you know, I think that what we're observing is a real recognition that digital health and virtual care are going to be key to value-based care and delivery models, to making them a success.
Yeah, absolutely.
So let's turn to virtual care specifically for
virtual
a moment.
Virtual care? I don't know anything about that.
Nothing about virtual care. Yeah, so, you know, I'm actually wondering whether we're just going to start using that term as the broad umbrella. It used to be telehealth was the umbrella for this type of thing.
Right.
That was the term that everyone used. But now I think it's really more virtual care. Telehealth is absolutely a component of that.
Yeah, or virtual first, right? We're hearing a lot first. About hybrid models, but all these, you know, hybrid meaning partially, you know, brick and mortar telemedicine, traditional, or sorry, brick and mortar healthcare delivery in person and telemedicine. But all of the hybrid, you know, quote unquote hybrid companies that we're seeing all have virtual front doors, right? So this is sort of a virtual first model. And over the last couple of months, including, you know, while we're at this conference, that has been what we're hearing over and over.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, someone on a panel today talked about sort of three categories of care. In-office care, as we have typically experienced, synchronous virtual care, synchronous telehealth generally, and then asynchronous care, mm-hmm. That are all going to play incredibly important roles just in the delivery of healthcare overall. That is going to be the definition of the delivery of healthcare, those three things. It's no longer just in-person care.
Yeah, well, and the exciting thing for all of us as individual humans and not companies is that the reason why this is happening is that everyone is taking an intensely patient-centered approach to this. There is a broad recognition that patients want their care when they want it, how they want it, in what manner they want it, in what location they want it. And all of these companies are saying, okay, well, how do we do this? Like, let's forget about how we have traditionally caused people to walk in our doors and say, maybe they need to come in, but like maybe they need a telehealth visit, or maybe we need to send a mobile phlebotomist to their house, right?
Yeah, there's much more the attitude of let's meet the patient where they are.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
Which I think is really neat. It's really neat.
I'm here for it.
Yeah. So so Roy again, Schoenberg, the CEO of Amwell, said, you know, we were talking about parity in one of these sessions, payment parity. And he said, you know, in actuality, here's the deal. If you are a provider or some kind of a healthcare delivery system and you are not offering telehealth, you're going to be marginalized. You're going to be marginalized. So that's a huge sea change as well. And, you know, I'm a big proponent of payment parity for sure, but it was an interesting way to look at things, right? There are perhaps going to be other incentives and other drivers at force for the adoption of telehealth rather than just sort of payment parity.
Yeah, and I'm hearing the same message from the major like VCs in the space. In their opinion, you know, failure to adopt value-based care models, failure to adopt technology, failure to orient yourself toward the patient is actually an existential threat. We heard that from one of the panelists while we are here, which is...
I love that language.
Yeah.
I love that language.
It's pretty stark. It's pretty stark.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you know, we've talked about healthcare before on this podcast as an issue of national security. Mm-hmm. And I think that language, I mean, it, you know, that says it all. This is an existential threat. And frankly, I agree. So turning to another component of virtual care, we have heard a lot of buzz about remote monitoring.
RPM.
But not just RPM, RTM as well. For sure. So you know, we've got remote patient monitoring, which has been around for a number of years now, or several years now. And now we've got remote therapeutic monitoring, where we're actually able to take into account therapy adherence and, you know, sort of non-physiologic metrics that are very, very important to the patient care, but are not necessarily captured by a separate peripheral device. And, you know, I think the recognition of these therapeutic components as a really critical part of, you know, providing care for the patient is a huge step forward. I was really glad to see CMS propose these new codes in the fee schedule. We will see come November whether, you know, sort of how they shake out and how they are finally adopted. But again, you know, we keep hearing the drumbeat here that this type of virtual care is actually going to be the driver for the shift to value-based care.
Absolutely.
So it's no longer all about the physician fee schedule and how much on a fee-for-service basis something is reimbursed. It's sort of a bigger picture.
Yeah, and it goes along with what we heard from, it might have been the CEO of CVS that was speaking, who said that home was going to become the mainstream site of care.
Yes.
If home is the mainstream site of care, then remote monitoring of patients is the primary care delivery mechanism.
Yeah.
Right? Wouldn't
yeah.
you say?
Yeah, absolutely. So I was in a session with Warner Thomas of Ochsner Health System, and he said, you know, listen, we are moving to a system where we are actually never discharging a patient.
Right.
We're never discharging a patient. We're simply changing the care setting. And the care itself is going to be continuous care. I mean, that's a pretty amazing concept.
Yeah, we heard that also from the CEO of Mayo Clinic.
Yes.
He said that in the future, healthcare, hospitals and healthcare systems have, where they're going to be moving from a pipeline model to a platform model, right? Where the health system is actually a single platform from which the patients get all of their care in all different ways, right? It's no longer the case that you have to get somebody to walk in the front door of your hospital in order for your hospital to make good money and manage patient care.
Yeah, it's kind of like an aggregator of the different types of services available,
yes.
Virtual, in-person, urgent, all
yeah.
of that.
I mean, we're going to see, I mean, I'm excited to see sort of hospital white-labeled solutions.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's a direction that we're going to see happening for sure.
Well, and they're big enough to take on the risk, right?
Yeah.
I mean, we are absolutely seeing bold vision from companies who are smaller, who are saying, we believe we can take on risk. But the healthcare system has a ton of folks that are not here at HLTH and not plugged into this conversation.
Yeah.
And I think very large hospitals and health systems are really going to be drivers of, you know, of the value-based delivery of healthcare.
Totally agree. And, you know, Warner from Ochsner again said, you know, think about this notion of care as being a continuous thing that mm-hmm. happens throughout, no matter where you are, is going to lead to better care for more patients at a fraction of the cost. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is going to help address the shortage of healthcare workers and the labor force. It really has ripple effects. Pretty
yes.
interesting.
Absolutely. I'm feeling a sense of urgency to move toward what I'm really excited to talk about next.
Cool. Do it.
Totally related. This is the fact that hospitals and urgent care companies, they're all talking about how we're going to bring not just sort of zooming into your home via video, but the actual delivery of hospital level care in the home.
Yeah.
Right? Digitally enabled home care models that include people walking in the front door of your home to tell you how to use your remote patient monitoring tools, mobile phlebotomy and mobile scanning. We heard that Dispatch Health, actually, who I thought was just like a mobile ED company or a mobile urgent care, rather, company, that is not what they are anymore. They are actually, I think they said they're the nation's largest mobile scanning provider. They're acquiring companies that can do full x-rays in the home.
And yeah, basically mobile, what's going to turn into mobile ED, right?
Absolutely, absolutely, right?
Yeah.
And you think, wow, that's like super expensive, right? Like, how do you do that? And there's a couple of ways that we're seeing that people are ideating around that. The first is driven by, certainly by the COVID 19 crisis, which is the government's hospital at home program.
Yeah.
That 90 different hospitals across the country signed up for, that created a waiver that essentially, the way I understand it, is they essentially pay the same rate that they would pay for the care in the hospital if that care is delivered in the home, right? And of course, things are very expensive in the hospital setting, high acuity. So that makes sense, right, financially. But outside of that waiver model where you're getting Part A payments, like hospital level Part A payments for care in the home, how do you make that make sense?
Right, yeah, that's the question.
That's the question. And
yeah.
It loops back to value-based care, of
yep.
course, right? But it's incredible. When you stop thinking about things on a unit-by-unit basis, right? Sending a doctor to someone's home is very expensive, right? On a fee-for-service basis, super expensive. But what if sending somebody into the home prevents a readmission that costs $100,000?
Right.
Well, maybe it's much cheaper to send nurses into homes, right? And we're starting to see payers really, really open up around this.
Taking the long-term view, right? A
100%.
Much more longitudinal model of care. Absolutely. Let's see, what else do we want to talk about? Pharmacy. You had some great sessions on digital pharmacy.
I did.
Telepharmacy, et cetera.
I did. You know, one company that knocked my socks off while I was here was Roe.
Oh, yeah.
Melinda Barnes, who I got to meet, who is lovely and also incredibly smart and a visionary, really. She talked to the audience about how Roe, which we know is a direct-to-consumer sort of med delivery business, that they were becoming a patient-centered healthcare system.
Wow. Wow.
Which I think dropped jaws in the room.
Yeah.
Right? They have, you know, I think a lot of people in the industry have been not taking them very seriously, thinking of them as a sort of a Instagram, direct-to-consumer, you know, small-time player, right? Big money, but small-time player in the... But when you look at sort of the big problems we're managing across the healthcare system, right? Big costs, very sick people, chronic conditions. You know, the percentage of GDP that healthcare is taking up in this country. Nobody's thinking like, well, Roe's probably thinking about that. Actually, I think they are.
Yeah.
They've been acquiring companies in the home diagnostic space, in the home health space. They are. They already have their own pharmacy that's delivering generics in many cases, completely outside of the PBM, insurance market, mm-hmm. at lower rates, according to Melinda Barnes, at lower rates for folks for generics than their local pharmacy can do, and they're doing it delivering to the home.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
They are talking about a true vertically integrated healthcare system.
Mm-hmm.
That starts virtual first.
Yeah.
But they're acquiring physical workers who are going into homes, right? This is what we're talking about now. It's absolutely incredible. And they're in the pharmacy space, right? We thought of them as pharmacy.
Well, yeah, and you know, on that note, CVS, Walgreens, Walmart, they are really obviously continuing their push into, you know, whole delivery, integrated delivery, mm-hmm. of care, and really pharmacy first, right? So remember, like that's where it's coming in, and then not just pharmacy first, but telepharmacy. Very interesting.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about which player in the healthcare system you and I see more than anyone else, it's definitely our pharmacist.
Sure, sure.
And if you have multiple chronic conditions and a whole list of medications, your pharmacist plays a fairly significant role,
right,
in your life, and they know the scope of what many of us think about a pharmacist is much more narrow than what they are actually trained and capable of doing.
Mm-hmm.
There are pharmacy companies that are certainly, Walgreens is certainly partnering with provider organizations. They have
Village MD.
Village MD, and then CVS has MinuteClinic.
Right.
But actually, the pharmacists are playing a very central role in those companies. And I think, again, payers are starting to realize that those pharmacists have a touch point through which they can engage patients, and patient engagement is the holy grail,
yeah,
right?
Totally.
If you can engage patients to manage their own care, to understand what they can do to keep themselves healthy, you win.
Right, right. And this kind of brings us to another point, right, about data. So it's data not only for payers and not only for providers. It's data for patients, right, that does allow them to actively engage in their care. I think as a general matter, we are seeing a move from a much more reactive approach to healthcare to a much more proactive approach to healthcare. When we have actionable data, and I kept hearing that term actionable, the data has to be actionable. When we have that, it allows us to be proactive. It allows us to be predictive. Super interesting.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we are certainly seeing a number of payers and providers and tech companies talk about how important risk stratification is,
mm-hmm.
to value-based care,
mm-hmm.
right? So
mm-hmm.
in a fee-for-service system, of course, everybody should get RPM, right? Because we make more money the more RPM we do, right? And there is an argument to be made that the more RPM you do, the better the outcomes later on. But does every single person need it?
No, we know
probably
that's not.
True. Yeah. Probably not. So you have to be able to risk stratify your patient population to insert resources where they are needed, where the patient can most benefit from them, to the end goal of not just reducing costs, but like keeping them better, right?
Yeah.
The sicker they are, the more expensive they are for the system. So from a data perspective, the only way you can do that is you have to have good data, you have to be able to make sense of the data, and you have to be able to present the data in a way that makes sense to the decision makers.
Yeah.
And that's where we get to the actionable part.
Mm-hmm.
And there are all sorts of ways to screw that up all along the way, right? Bad inputs, wrong inputs, inconsistent inputs, and then a platform that, you know, Carrie and I used to go around to these conferences like 6 or 7 years ago, and everybody knew that they were the answer for data analytics.
Right.
And we would get into these conversations with these companies and realize they've got great, you know, they've got a ton of data. Like what does it mean?
And no one
right?
knows
this
is, what to
this
do with it.
This dashboard has the best color scheme.
Yeah.
Ever.
For sure. It was definitely about the color scheme.
But what does it mean? Like if I'm a family physician, or I'm running an ED, or I'm running an entire hospital system, how do I use this data to make decisions? Super, super interesting stuff. The other thing I want to bring up is a lot of talk here around the V1 of interoperability, right? Mickey Tripathi said in jest, we're done. We did it. We did interoperability. Yay.
Check.
Yeah. Yeah. But actually, very thoughtfully said, we are learning new things all of the time. We are focusing on the goal of making sure that data for patients is accessible, and then between providers, because we still do have a siloed healthcare system. And by the way, we need lots of different providers, right? We need competition. We need probably more competition than we have.
Yes.
And we have to have those providers be able to send information back and forth between each other. It's just going to, you know, I don't think the answer is one centralized place where every piece of information is and that's where everybody has to go. But a lot about interoperability, the work that has to be done. Mickey Tripathi announced a new initiative with CDC and the ONC working on, more making the standard measures that they have more robust, more useful. And for any of you out there that are in the data management, data enhancement, data harmonization business, these are initiatives that allow private industry to absolutely help set priorities with the government,
right,
in partnership, so that they can hasten whatever their priority project is, but also so that when the government releases these standards, you're not, industry isn't scrambling around going, this makes no sense to me. Why is it this way? We have to rewrite everything.
Yeah. Then we also heard about data as a way of, as a means of achieving another goal that Liz Fowler talked about, which is health equity.
Absolutely.
And,
I love hearing that over and over again.
We have heard that a lot during this conference.
She said equity is central in every aspect of our work.
Yeah.
It was so striking that I wrote it down word for word.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And so, data obviously has a role to play in that. Decentralized clinical trials, I think, also has a role to play in that health equity aspect.
Yes. Yeah. We are so excited about DCT. I mean, it makes a lot of sense. I didn't come from a clinical trial background. There are extremely smart people that work with me that have begun to educate me on this, but absolutely, it has to exist.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, now that we have the capability of identifying through our data projects, identifying patients who are the best position to serve in clinical trials to advance our medical knowledge, especially people who are generally not included in clinical trials.
Right.
Right?
Absolutely.
We want diverse groups of participants. We have to have that data to make our solutions more robust. If they live in Cleveland and the trial is going on in LA, why shouldn't they be able to participate?
No reason.
Why we have heard stories from individuals in our lives where they said, well, we had to pack up, we moved.
Yeah, to participate in this trial.
We had to move as a family to participate in this trial. It's crazy to me.
Yeah, no
it's crazy to me. The other thing that's very cool and a little bit future-y, right? We Carrie and I spent a lot of time talking about what's the next thing on the horizon, but we don't do a ton of talking about what's 20 and 30 years down the line. Mm-hmm. I'm going to make that my 2022 resolution.
I'm going to become a future view?
Yes, okay. Really long term. But one of the things that they were talking about as we were having this conversation about decentralized clinical trials is the digital twin. They didn't use this term, but it's what they were talking about. We have a couple of clients who are working on digital twin technology. But essentially, this is taking someone from the physical world and making a digital representation of them. And when you're talking about
Spooky.
But when you're talking about clinical trials in particular, what these folks on the stage were saying is at some point we're going to get such good data about you, Carrie Nixon, you know, about your genetics, about your history, about your makeup, about people like you have had similar experiences and have similar makeup, that we're going to be able to move through clinical trials without you, Carrie Nixon, participating in that trial.
I'm all for that.
Yeah.
I'm all for that.
Yeah, which I think is really, from a safety perspective, I mean, I don't know enough about it to be as scared as I probably should be about that in the near term, but in the long term, why can't we do that?
Yeah.
Right? Why can't we do that?
Sounds like we're going that direction.
Well, we are headed there. We are headed there. And very, very smart people. And people committed to advancing our medical knowledge and really like improving our lives. Right? We're going to stop talking about substantive things right now. And it's very late in the day.
I know.
But I wanted to bring it back to the fact that everyone that I've met, at least here, and I'd love to hear your perspective about that as well, Carrie. They're here because they believe in the mission of the companies that are here, right?
Right.
This is a corporate event, right? People are selling things. We're selling things. But why are we here?
Because we care.
Yeah. I mean, this is what, being a famous podcast host.
Almost famous.
Is not the most fulfilling thing.
Come on.
In our lives.
But, you know, everyone here is trying to better healthcare, make healthcare better.
And people.
Yeah, and make people better. So it's a super cool thing.
Yeah. You should come next year.
Everyone should come next year.
You should come.
We'll invite you on the podcast. So we've talked forever. You can probably hear the enthusiasm and the excitement in our voices. We're practically talking over each other. It also is very late in our third day of conference, and so we're a little giddy. Should we sign? Anything
giddy.
Else before
giddy
we sign
Giddy is a good
off?
Word.
Yeah, totally.
Well, Carrie, what was your favorite part of this? I know you're dying to talk about your favorite part of this.
The puppies.
Yeah.
It was
totally
the puppies.
Yeah. Sorry, we didn't frame it that way, but this was Carrie Nixon's absolute favorite part.
You gotta love the puppies.
They do also have what is that called? It's air hockey. It's air. Oh. They have air hockey.
Yeah, there are games.
There's like car video game things.
There are video games.
I'm a very serious person, as you can tell, so I wouldn't be caught dead doing something like that.
No.
But it's
they need karaoke.
It's such a good environment. It's brutal. I mean, this is a brutal pace.
Yeah.
Especially if you haven't been to a conference in
2 years.
2 years.
Yeah.
It's a brutal pace. So like, stop and. Pet the puppies.
Totally.
It was a great idea. Anyway, I'm done.
All right. Thanks, everyone. We'll talk to you on our next episode.
Yes, tune in. Bye.